I'll wait till the clock strikes a nerve to spend some time with you. For the sake of making a statement, let's make our presence known. That's the starting line. I'm Blake Murphy. This is Jays Talk Plus. Clock almost striking the end of the season here, but we expect Bo Bichette back tonight to make a little bit of a statement, make that presence known heading into 2025. Of course, over 12 games to end the season, probably all of which he won't play in. You're not going to expect big things, but this is probably the nicest silver lining. The Raptors. Can you tell it's almost the end of the baseball season? The Blue Jays could put on their season here, get Bo Bichette back on the field, get him healthy, get him having some positive results here. Not that the results matter all that much, but something to look forward to in this series against the Texas Rangers, something to look forward to over these final 2 weeks of the season beyond setting some loony dog record I got a PR email about before I came on today and didn't read. Good for you people eating a bunch of hot dogs on Tuesdays. I guess I could participate in that. I'm going to the game with friends on Tuesday. Cool. Okay, there is baseball tonight. The Blue Jays are back in action at 8 o'clock against the Texas Rangers for a 3-set. There was also baseball last night and some interesting developments around Major League Baseball. The Chicago White Sox, our Chicago White Sox, won a third game in a row as they try to avoid making Major League Baseball history with the most losses ever. They are currently at 36-115. They, of course, have to lose six more games to break the record. Trying to get hot here. Trying to take a couple off the Angels and avoid that for as long as possible. Three wins in a row. It was the first time they'd won two games in a row since June. We'll see. I don't know that they're going to be able to avoid it, but good for them. Luis Arraez also had a pretty incredible streak end last night. He had gone 141 plate appearances without striking out. That goes back to August 10th. So over a month, like we're talking five and a half weeks since he last struck out. He hit almost 400 over that stretch. It is the longest such streak without a strikeout since Juan Pierre back in 2004. Guy who I think has gotten underrated over time because while he had the profile of a like slap hitting and speed guy, he's also a pretty good OBP guy. 343 career on base to go with all those stolen bases. So not quite your Billy Hamilton, Estuary Ruiz type. A lot of ability to steal more bases because he was on base. Anyway, Luis Arraez, not a big base stealer, but good for him going 141 plate appearances without a strikeout. Elsewhere in baseball, we also have more of an American League wildcard race than maybe we anticipated a couple weeks ago. The Detroit Tigers won yesterday and the Minnesota Twins lost. So that gap for the final wildcard spot is down to a game and a half here. The Tigers have 11 games left. The Twins have 12 left, just a game and a half separating them. The Mariners are also only two games back of the Twins. So we're going to have meaningful American League baseball down the stretch here. We kind of look like a week ago that wouldn't be the case, that maybe teams would be jockeying for seeding and that's about it. And then of course, over in the National League, the Mets with a one game lead on the Braves for the final play a wild card spot. Arizona a game clear of the Mets. And Francisco Lindor getting kind of good news yesterday that his wonky back will not require, there's no structural damage, won't require an IL stint for now, but he's going to miss a couple days and that could be crucial for the Mets. We'll talk about some of that stuff later in the show. We will get you set up for Blue Jays Rangers, and let's start by doing that with the voice of the Blue Jays on the Sportsnet Radio Network, Ben Schulman. Ben, good morning. How are we doing, buddy?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me. How are you?
I'm good, man. Got to ask you before we get into the Jays stuff. It was only 12 for 14, 122 yards, one touchdown, but they get the win. How are you feeling Malik Willis-wise with your Packers?
I'm feeling great. It was 4 or 5 years ago maybe that I went to the Carrier Dome and watched Malik Willis absolutely shred my Syracuse Orange as a new transfer quarterback from Auburn for Liberty University. And all the flashes that I saw there, I saw in the game. And other than, fumbling, Josh Jacobs was phenomenal. And I think the biggest thing for Malik Willis is a guy threw up on the ball in the middle of the game and he improvised in that moment and made a play out of it. And I think that's the it factor that a quarterback needs. So I think if you can deal with basically not knowing the playbook and someone spewing on the ball a little bit and you can win a football game, then you're prepared for this level.
I would love to see Trevor Lawrence run back some of what he did against your Syracuse Orange while he was at Clemson, 3-0 against them. It's been bleak, man. It's not great when your backup quarterback is a nicer story than my starting quarterback, but I am happy for you and the abnormal amount of Packers fans around this Blue Jays team.
I will say, I believe Trevor Lawrence threw one pick six in his entire collegiate career, and I believe it was Garrett Williams of Syracuse who took it back. We almost got him once. We didn't get him, but we almost got him once, but he did beat us all three times.
Yeah, it's now he doesn't throw pick sixes because they don't have him throw anything more than 5 yards downfield. Anyway, let's talk baseball here because I'll get too upset otherwise. A beautiful weekend down at the ballpark for that Jays Cardinals series. Jays sweep. You get speak of beautiful weather, you changed out broadcast partners for the weekend with Chris LaRue off on in the south of Spain. You get him back tonight, right?
Yeah. I mean he was a little worried about strikes and stuff when he left, but as far as I'm aware, he's back. I gotta text him and make sure. But he should be back tonight and on the call with me.
Yeah, he'll be nice and bronzed and rested. It'll be good. Okay, so we will also get the return, we think. It's not official yet, but the return of Bo Bichette, just as meaningful as the return of Chris LaRue, and certainly a much longer absence in the case of Bo Bichette. Assuming he's back tonight as anticipated, what are you looking for from him over these final 12 games?
I mean, first off, just health. Like, as long as he can run hard and move laterally and swing as hard as he needs to, like, I'm not worried if he takes a wild swing and miss as long as he feels good after it to a certain extent, because he's a guy that plays at such a high, I feel like, intensity level or exerts so much and puts a lot of stress on his body. So if he can do that like his usual self and not feel any effects of it, that's thing number one. But I think we all know that it would be much better for the Blue Jays if Bo Bichette had a really nice 2 weeks than if he, you know, had a tough 2 weeks. And so you'd like to see some hits. I don't know that you need to see him absolutely blasting doubles down the left field line or hitting that many homers, but I think you'd like to see, you know, a little bit of that Bo Bichette consistency that we got so used to over the last year and a half, probably before this season, where he's kind of a shoe-in to pick up a hit in each game and can flick a second one over the second baseman into right field late in the game as well. So to see that consistent quality contact would be nice from Bo, but first off is obviously just him being healthy and doing what he can do to be on the field.
Especially with that calf having flared up three different times this year, right? Like, you would love to see, okay, well, he played four with AAA. Let's see him get 10 here. And then there's no question coming into spring training for him, okay, my calf's good, heading into your offseason work and things like that. In terms of, you know, like you said, results, it would be better for him to play well over these last 12 games than not play well, but it doesn't really matter all that much. In terms of level setting for 2025 for Bo Bichette, where are your expectations going to be? Because this is a guy who, unquestionably, this was a very, very bad year. The 80 games he played were well below the standard of Bo Bichette, well below the standard of even an average hitting, you know, middle infielder. Like, he was hitting .222 with a sub 600 OPS, but before he went on the IL here. But it's also a guy who has hit .290 for his career, and until this year, .290 on every single season that he's been in the majors, a guy who's led the majors in hits, or led the American League, rather, in hits a couple of times. How do you contextualize that? Like, where will your expectation level be for Bo Bichette come spring training next year?
Yeah, it's a tough one. I think for now, I'm still fairly comfortable expecting him to do what he did each of the last couple of years before this season. You know, I do think this season was a tough one for him, but because he played so few games after that injury, it's hard to know how much to take seriously. Could he have ripped off something in the second half, kind of like Vlad got on a tear 2 months into the season, or Bo did, you know, back in 2022 when he really struggled for the first 3 or 4 months and then went on a tear? I think that's entirely possible. I mean, until this year, Bo Bichette was the most consistent Blue Jays hitter there had been, I think, in quite a while, year to year, in terms of batting average, at least. Like, that's, he was, like you said, I mean, .290 every single year, and had a real shot at the batting title last year if he didn't get hurt. So I think if you look at last year's numbers, I probably would frame an expectation around there. You know, last year's numbers ended up coming down a little bit from their absolute peak because he got hurt. And so I'm not asking him to do what he did for the first 3 months of 2023 when he was hitting almost 330 and really just automatic. But if he can be 290 to 305, 15 to 20 home runs, 70 to 85 RBIs, I mean, that's a huge weapon for the Blue Jays and certainly someone they'll hit in their top four.
Even including the down year this year, since Bo Bichette came up to the majors, he is 12th in batting average. So pretty good. And that's in the entire major leagues. That includes at least one player in Tim Anderson, who's just floating around aimlessly now. So, you know, arguably a top 10 hitter for batting average since he stepped in the league, including this year's, you know, shaky sample there. The other question that flows from this, Ben, and it's, you know, not a huge deal, but are we expecting Luis de los Santos, the odd man out here, maybe roster move wise? Obviously they've tried to get him in a little bit there, but you know, kind of a, for lack of a better term, an org depth guy, not one of the guys that they're trying to see every day down the stretch here.
That's what I'd guess. You know, they gave him the start too in the last game of the last series, which I just was looking at that in the lineup and I thought, oh, maybe, you know, you want to give him a start on his last day. I mean, it's entirely possible it's not, you know, and maybe 3 days ago it would have been David Schneider. Who knows? Like, I have no idea, but he has hit homers in back-to-back games. And I imagine that he's going to stay up. And I think everyone else, like you said, is a little bit more of a prospect probably, you know, and some of that is just optics and where you were drafted and all that. But I think that likely De Los Santos goes down. I mean, he was the guy who came up. So in theory, he's kind of that 27th or 28th man right now on that roster.
Yeah, it'd be interesting. And last time he went back down, he got a nice little heater for Buffalo, just like Stuart Baroa has done this time. So it's nice this time of year that for one more week, at least these guys can go down and get actual reps. You know, there are six games left in that Buffalo Bison season. So at least he won't just be, you know, sitting on a taxi squad the rest of the way. You mentioned David Schneider there. Obviously a very big weekend for him, a big week in general, because he had a pretty clutch hit earlier in that that week as well. What have you made of not just the struggles that he's gone through, but how he's handled that and the way really the team kind of rallied around him this week as those things moved in the right direction? I know, you know, once they're back to being a competitive team that's trying to play for a playoff spot, we wouldn't care about that stuff maybe quite as much. But I do think in seasons like this, you can learn a little something about the guys, about the way the team functions and things like that. What have you picked up from David Schneider's struggles and the maybe climb back out of it the last couple games?
Yeah, obviously the struggles have been immense. And it kind of feels like in the span of a calendar year, David Schneider's lived out an entire major league career. I mean, he's had a big debut. He's been a hero. He's been the most popular guy on the team in a city. He's gone through slumps. He's come out of that, you know, early in this year and was hitting leadoff for the Blue Jays for a large portion, back in a slump, and now, you know, is looking like he's starting to come out of it again. I think, you know, he's always adjusting, and so I think that he's found himself, it seems, in a decent spot to cover the ball a little bit more outside the last 2 days. That first home run, he obviously went the other way. The second home run, it was mostly middle. Like, it wasn't a great pitch, but it was a little bit away, and he got around it, and he struggled with pitches on the outside. And then, you know, from the emotional standpoint, I think that there are a few guys really as popular as a Davis Schneider in that clubhouse. I mean, you know, he is just so well-liked from everyone in there, and I think they, you know, are really rooting for him overall. You know, he definitely has two really good friends in Clement and Horwitz in that clubhouse. But I think that a lot of the guys, especially a lot of the established Blue Jays who have now been with Schneider for the whole year, are pretty big fans of his and have been very excited to see him, you know, get out of this. And like you said, you know, you don't always see this unless the team is struggling. But because they struggled, rather than sending Schneider down, they had the opportunity to keep him with the team. And there's a chance that, you know, he's found something here in the last couple of weeks and it carries into next season. And it's something that, you know, could be important for them competing going forward.
Yeah. And at least, you know, send him into a 2025 camp competition in a better spot, not with, you know, the you don't want, and you never, nobody wants to end their season on a slump, and you have to wait 6 months before you get to figure it out and get in there hacking, trying to get your way out of it. Okay, one other roster move for this series, and a bit of a surprise. The Jays have designated Brian Servin for assignment and claimed and will activate old friend Tyler Heineman, who was let go by the Boston Red Sox. He has bounced up and down for the Red Sox this year, similar to Brian Servin with the Blue Jays, because, hey, headline item, the Jays traded Danny Jansen to the Red Sox, and that affected both Tyler Heineman and Brian Servin. Turns out, in retrospect, we could have skipped the middleman and sent Tyler Heineman back in that trade. What'd you make of this one? I know the organization has liked Tyler Heineman, but a move like this with 2 weeks left in the season caught me a little off guard.
I was surprised, just like you. You know, I'm not sure that I had any illusions, not a Tyler Heineman pun, but any illusions about Brian Servin being a long-term, you know, Blue Jay. Like, I was not expecting anything more than potentially him being back in that same kind of third reserve catch role next year. But given what he had done working with Bowden Francis recently, you know, even some good starts with Yariel Rodriguez over the last couple, I thought he'd go to the rest of the year. I mean, especially for the Francis reason, I thought they'd just keep them together, finish out the year, have Francis with the same guy who was really rolling with, and then go forward. And I guess, you know, I think Tyler Heineman has provided a little more with the bat over the last couple of years, and obviously they know him very well, so I understand that. But I also am not feeling, you know, super confident that Tyler Heineman has much long-term with the Blue Jays like Brian Servin. So I do wonder what the ultimate motivation of this move was. You know, perhaps it's, you know, getting Heineman in, and maybe they want him back in that third reserve catcher role for next year, and so they get him now and try to sign him for next season. But I was definitely surprised. You know, I thought that at this point that we would not see a move that moved away from Brian Servin.
Yeah, and it's interesting. Obviously, Heineman has like a little bit more track record with the bat. Their OPS at AAA this year are 13 points apart. So they basically hit identical batting lines at AAA. Here's an interesting one. You know who caught Bowden Francis's first career major league appearance when he threw 2/3 out of a bullpen?
Tyler Heineman.
Tyler Heineman, back a couple years ago. Yeah, it's interesting, too. I do wonder, like, I'm with you on Brian Servin and Bowden Francis had a good thing going. I do wonder if, you know, hey, part of the challenge here for Bowden Francis over these last couple starts is Brian Servin's not going to be here next year. Can you pick up another catcher on the fly? Bowden Francis actually had really good numbers pitching to Danny Jansen as well. He had a 2.29 ERA in the 17 appearances he made pitching to Jansen, 2.65 with Servin and 4.19 with Kirk. So maybe they want to get him, you know, reps with Kirk or just learning how to work with another catcher. I'm not sure. I'm reaching here a little bit. I do. So I know you play fantasy. Do you have a Tyler Heineman, like that guy that this year's the best version of this in Major League Baseball this year is the Cleveland Guardians and Anthony Gose. They've cut him and added him back like 30. Go look at his MLB transactions page later. It is like pages and pages long of just DFA'd, re-added the 40 man. Have you had a guy like that for you over the years in fantasy that, like, for whatever reason, you just keep seem to adding back, and then the second you need to make a change, okay, that's the guy I drop, but I'm going to add him back and then I'll drop him. Do you have one of those?
Yeah, I haven't had him this year at all, but the Ravens running back Justice Hill.
Okay.
I found like I was always picking Justice Hill up or occasionally like, what was his name? There was another guy that wasn't Gus Edwards in that backfield with him. But the Ravens, I feel like, just always seem to get, like, you know, Dobbins kept getting hurt or someone would get hurt. Mark Ingram would get hurt. And so I'd end up with this third or fourth string running back riding the option train for me, basically going back and forth and back and forth. So, you know, well, I'm hoping to not have to do that with quarterbacks this year, but I'm in a little bit of trouble fantasy-wise right now. But I would say Justice Hill is my biggest one.
Yeah, well, I could give you some advice on what to do with your fantasy quarterback situation, and it's don't exclusively pick Packers and ex-Packers. That's the move there. Okay, so we don't have probables for this series yet. If the Jays stayed on turn, they'll go Bassett, Francis, Gausman. But again, they did this kind of last time, and then they ended up using Ryan Burr at the start of a series when we maybe thought he'd be at the end of a series. That aside, let's assume it's Bassett, Francis, Gausman. How encouraging is it for you, given the workload that these veteran guys have had, that a guy like Gausman, a guy like Berríos, to a lesser extent Bassett, we'll see if Bassett can have a good one these last two times through. But is it meaningful for you for these guys to be finishing strong, given that one of the things we were talking about 6 weeks ago is, you know, how do you manage the cumulative fatigue with these guys? How do you make sure they're okay for 2025 without shutting them down?
Yeah, I think it's pretty big. I mean, Jose Berríos, you know, first, I mean, he just never shows any sign of any fatigue. It's really incredible what he's been able to do. I mean, he is just dominant in year after year after year. And, you know, sometimes it's a circuitous route to get to an ERA that's in the mid threes, where he has a great start and then a tough middle and then gets, you know, on a big roll again. But he always finds himself in that spot where he's put together another really nice season for you. He's flirting with 200 innings. He'll probably be more like 190 this year. And he's, you know, probably pitched in a lot of wins for your team because he goes deep and he pitches so often. And then Kevin Gausman, I think it's just big because he's kind of been Kevin Gausman for almost 2 months. I mean, if you look at least numbers wise, maybe not totally eye test wise, because the punch outs aren't always there. And sometimes the splitter isn't quite what it was last year and the year before. But I mean, to have Kevin Gausman, who's thrown more innings than anyone in that Blue Jays staff, be able to go out there and provide the outings he's provided, I think it gives you more confidence going into next season that a normal start and a normal spring for Gausman could yield another pretty big year.
Yeah, which would be great. And look, this team is banking on it in 2025. Whatever they do this offseason, Gausman, Berríos, Bassett are going to be 3/5 of that rotation and a good chunk of the payroll. And it's paramount that those guys be in a good place for them and continue this run of, I know the Jays have had less than zero good health fortune in the minor leagues on the pitching side, but at the major league level with those three guys over the last couple of years and Yusei Kikuchi before he was traded away, they have been able to keep those guys remarkably healthy. With respect to the bullpen behind those guys, if we get a bullpen day today or at some point in this series, of these guys that they've picked up, there are 11 guys that have pitched or 11 relievers on the 40-man who were not in the organization to start the season. Have any of these guys moved the needle for you in terms of what you think of them long-term? I know at one point you know, we're interested in a Ryan Burr, a Tommy Nance, someone like that. Have any of these guys, you know, none of these guys are going to be penciled in for the seventh or eighth inning next year. But do you think any of them have shown enough that you'd like a longer looking camp if you're the Blue Jays?
You know, I think Nance's mix is just so funky that I'd like to see a little bit more of it. You know, I his curveball is so unique. You know, Brendan Little kind of throws a curveball as hard as him too, although I find that that's just them having two guys with an extremely rare pitch. So I'm still interested in looking at that, I think. And I wouldn't say that I'm by any means totally out on Ryan Burr. I think that there's still some things there that you like. So I wouldn't mind bringing them into spring training. I think you could argue last spring that there was a little bit of a lack of guys on spring training invite minor league deals that had pitched relief in the majors before. Like, I think they could have had a few more veterans in spring on those minor league deals than maybe they did last year. So I'd probably bring both of those two in, but I think Nance is the one that's probably, at least right now, caught my eye the most.
Yeah, he's got one, maybe not marquee pitch, but one really good pitch, and that's something to build on if you have an offseason of, you know, figuring out how to improve the fastball or the usage, the deployment, things like that. Okay, last one for you. A guy, I don't think we've talked about him this year on the show, but I know it's a guy you're fond of. Nathan Lucas, when given the opportunity this year, has been really, really solid. We're talking, it's only 47 plate appearances, but he's got like a 928 OPS. And this is a guy who, yes, he was 29 years old, is now 30 years old. But for the second year in a row at AAA, the fourth year in a row at AAA, was like, I got nothing left to learn down here. Like, I'm here as a depth guy. But, you know, numbers wise, there was never any doubt that he was at worst a quad A guy. Maybe it's not with the Jays because they're kind of over indexed to lefty bench bats. But do you think Nathan Lucas has put himself in a good position to, you know, fight for a major league roster spot somewhere next year?
I think so. I think he's likely the subject of a trade, you know, and could be you know, snapped up by some team who either, you know, it could be a developing team who might need a center fielder out there. And I really think that he could play every day for a team like that. Or, you know, it's a team that hasn't had Kevin Kiermaier and Dalton Varsho in center field the last couple of years, and therefore could use a defensive replacement slash a guy who can hit left and play center field and play the corners as well. So I think Nathan Lucas has shown himself certainly to be a major leaguer. You know, I even think at times it was hard to even say he was quad A or 4A because he just never even got a chance last year. I mean, he had, I believe, 26 at-bats or 29 at-bats the entire season last year. He's already passed that this year, and he's been up for 2 weeks. So I think that, you know, he's shown himself at AAA and now in a brief stint at the majors to be able to hang in there, make good contact, play good defense, you know, and he can base run for you and do a couple other things too if you need it. So I think he's a major leaguer. Like you said, I'm not sure the best fit is with the Blue Jays, but I'm hoping for him that whether it's the Blue Jays or somewhere else, he's playing consistently in the majors next year, because I think he's really earned that at this point.
Yeah, and gotta love a beard and tattoo guy on the roster. Nice to have some representation there as well. Ben, sorry, I lied. I got one more for you. Do you know yet who won the Jays Care Foundation broadcast auction to get to sit in the booth with you? Like, have they looped you in on that? Do you know when that's happening or anything like that?
They already came in.
Oh.
They came in on Saturday.
How was it?
It was great. It was great. It was, I don't know if I should say their name. So I'll just say it was two people. It was a man and his son who was interested in getting into radio. You know, so that was very cool. And they came and sat between us and, you know, took the game in and asked some interesting questions. And it was a lot of fun. It was definitely very cool.
That's awesome. Glad to hear that. And very good of you to do that and donate your time and energy there to a good cause. Ben Schulman, thank you for donating your time to this much less meaningful cause joining me this morning.
Well, I hope I can get a tax receipt for donating to this, but I appreciate it, Blake. Have a good one.
Absolutely not. You can get at best a coffee at the next Blue Jays game. Thanks, man. Ben Schulman, voice of the Toronto Blue Jays on the Sportsnet Radio Network. He'll be back on the call with Chris LaRue as the Jays start a three-game set against the Rangers tonight. It's an 8:05 start, 8:05 tomorrow, and then we get a 2:35 game on Thursday, which is always nice for people like me who don't work real jobs and can turn a game on in the middle of the day. We don't know the starters for the Blue Jays yet, but if they were to stay on turn, it'll be Bassett, Francis, and Gausman. They will line up against Nate Eovaldi, Cody Bradford, and Kumar Rocker. So, you know, interesting mix there. Eovaldi, by the way, is four innings away from hitting his vesting option, which would lock in $20 million for him next year. So I would imagine he's going to want to go four-plus innings today against the Blue Jays. Cody Bradford tomorrow. We'll set it up more tomorrow. Interesting one where the stuff isn't that good, but he does not walk anybody and hasn't walked anybody through the minor leagues. Those pitch metrics that mostly measure the quality of your stuff, but also have a location component. Love the way he locates his pitches. He's kind of a throwback, 90 miles an hour pitching on the edges. It'll be interesting to see how the Jays handle that. And then obviously Kumar Rocker, who we talked a bunch about last week because he's a former number three pick who, you know, 2.5 years after being drafted, made his major league debut. And it was a very good one with a very nasty slider. Should be a fun series as far as a late season series between two games, a bunch of games below, two teams, a bunch of games below 500. Go. Okay, we got a loaded show today, by the way. We're going to talk to Mike Petriello of MLB.com, Chelsea Janes of the Washington Post. We'll talk to David Murphy, former Texas Ranger and now Rangers color analyst, to set up the Rangers side of the series. And after we take a break here, we're going to talk to Tom Hackamer. He is a former minor league baseball player who just wrapped up his season in the Mexican Winter League. He also does a baseball podcast. I want to talk to him a bit about his career, what it's like to be a submarine pitcher. He's got kind of that, if you remember Chad Bradford in Moneyball, that kind of delivery. And he did a really cool YouTube series while he was building back up from Tommy John surgery, going into everything that went into that, a 19-part YouTube series about his recovery, getting the velocity back and things like that. Fascinated to pick his brain on all that and talk some Mexican League baseball. Tom Hackamer next as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Diving deep into Leafs, Raptors, Jays, and NFL. The JD Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Jays back in action tonight. We'll continue to set that series up a little later in the show. Right now, though, we're going to be joined by Tom Hackamer, former minor league baseball player through Indie Ball, Mexican League this past year, also co-host of the StaffCast podcast. Tom, what's up, man? Thanks for joining us.
I'm honored to be here. Thank you for having me for all of those various, you know, maybe remarkable accolades, maybe not.
I think they're pretty remarkable. I mean, I didn't get to minor league baseball or Mexican League baseball or anything like that. How was the Mexican League season? I know you guys just wrapped up the playoffs not too long ago and pretty successful year for Dos Loredos.
Yeah, we had a pretty solid year. I threw pretty well considering I didn't know what I was getting into. I didn't know the quality of the league. I didn't know a bunch of other things. It was a really great experience, and I was really happy to get to just pitch in a different country and get to sort of experience that and sort of see if I still have anything left in the tank, which I didn't really know after I finished my my TJ rehab.
Which, of course, as I mentioned before our last commercial break, people can go to your YouTube and check out the kind of 19-part series of you coming back from that Tommy John through the rehab. What led you to make the Mexican League choice? I know when you first came back, there was a little bit of indie ball. Is this like did you kind of feel the crunch of there are fewer minor league levels now, so you kind of had to go that route to get back?
Yeah, absolutely. That is, I just didn't have the opportunities to go back into affiliated minor league ball. So that was the best opportunity that I had was to go play in the Mexican League. And it pays relatively well, especially compared to independent ball. It's probably commensurate with minor league ball now, but it used to be way more. And now it's still definitely better than I was getting paid in indie ball.
So the pay is commensurate with minor league ball. Now that you know and have a season down there, How does the quality of competition, the quality of play down there compare to those, you know, upper levels of affiliated minor league ball?
So I haven't, and we've talked about this pretty extensively on StaffCast, the podcast that I co-host, but it sort of reminds me of what AAA was when I was there, which has changed since I've been told. I haven't been there. Because we had a lot of, when I was in AAA, it was still a place where you had a lot of old guys with names that you would remember kind of deal. Like I played with Vance Worley, Zach Godley, Josh Reddick, guys who were like still like had aspects of their game that were that of quality big leaguers, like their command or their ability to make the ball move, their ability to make contact. And that player is, you know, the kind of guy that's been squeezed out by the contraction of the minor leagues. And I think what ended up happening is a lot of those guys have ended up in the Mexican League. So it reminded me a lot of, you know, my season in AAA.
Yeah, which, you know, that's really interesting. And Reddick's a great pull. Just always a fondness for him for using wrestling entrance themes as his walk-up music. It's interesting to hear that. And like, obviously the crunch in the minor leagues and how many minor league contracts teams can have, there's an obvious impact to that. And I don't know that people's first instinct is to think of, you know, a guy with service time like a Reddick or a Worley trying to stick around so they can, hey, team needs a final day of the season starter, you get back. Or in your case, a 29, 30 year old working their way back from injury. You said you didn't, there were a couple things you didn't know about the Mexican League when you went down there. How did you find the element where you're pitching at elevation a little bit more? I know that that's something, you know, I'm not the most well-versed in how pitches are effective at Coors Field, for example, but I have talked to a couple pitchers who are like, yeah, the stuff doesn't move left to right the same way. You know, my changeup doesn't move the right way. The sinker doesn't come back. Did you find that pitching at elevation a little bit more that your pitches were different?
Yeah. So I understood it theoretically that's how it worked. And it's a really, really different thing when you actually get in there and you see the like magnitude of how much it changes. The first time we played at a little bit above sea level, as low as you can get in that league. And every other team was a minimum of 2,500 feet, which is half the elevation of Coors, but at least twice as high as any other big league park. And the first time we went somewhere that had like, you know, 2,500, 3,000 feet of elevation, I was just like, oh, this is my pitches are never going to move ever again. And then we went to places that were like 6,000 feet. And I was like, oh, this is terrible. And when we got back to like 3,000 feet, I was just like, oh, the movement's back. It's okay. It's incredible how quickly you can get adjusted to it. But like there was, I just had to like scrap pitches and like change how I threw at when we were at the places that were like a mile high. Like my sinker sinkers don't move. There's something about seam-based movement that lack of air density just makes way, way worse for some reason. So like my slider, which usually goes across, was much more of a downer, almost like curveball. And I could only throw my four seam, which just sort of still worked well enough. And my changeup was really hit or miss. The only home run I gave up this year was on a changeup. I tried to throw at elevation and it just didn't do anything.
Man, that's so fascinating. It also, I've made this comment a bunch of times on the show over the years, but like the fact that every analytics department person you talk to inside baseball, never on record, but everyone always points out how the Rockies have like nobody looking at this stuff whatsoever. And they're the one team that would benefit the most from like a physicist or two, or like understanding seam shifted weight. That's a little above my head physics wise, but it's crazy that like a smart team should be able to like help their pitchers more than, I mean, if you play 81 of your games there, or you play your entire season there in the Mexican League, like there are ways that you can kind of strategize or build around that, right? Like you got used to it and adjusted more.
Yeah, I think that it's actually like, I said it the first time we played at, where was it? Durango, which is at about 6,000 feet. So almost 1,000 higher than Coors. It's like, if the Rockies like were really serious about like you would pick guys out of like these kinds of teams. Like if someone's pitching here and having success, like you should like at least see if they can help you. Like clearly they've got something that's working with the elevation. I don't know enough about how that works, because I know the big thing, I remember the Rockies signed Brian Shaw, a huge cutter guy for Cleveland in their World Series run. And they were like, this is like, you know, it's going to be great. The elevation will make your cutter even better. And it all made sense. And then he was terrible. And I don't exactly understand why that happened. So clearly I don't get it entirely, but there's probably, I it shocked me that like teams like Colorado, well, I guess there's only one team like Colorado, aren't looking more at those kinds of teams where you have like, this is a unique environment in the US, in the MLB. It should be an advantage, and yet it's not.
And Shaw's an interesting one, because like he had those bad years in Colorado and then went back to Cleveland and figured it back out briefly. It didn't, you know, he was like 35 by then, I think, but like he had a resurgence right when he went back to Cleveland.
It wasn't totally gone.
Right. And yeah, it's fascinating. Okay, so in terms of how this stuff translates, what does the next little bit look like for you? You posted a 2.20 ERA down there heading into the offseason now. To the extent that you're willing to talk about that stuff, what does the offseason ahead look like for you?
Well, I am in about 3 weeks. I am heading to the DR to play the first half of that season, the Dominican Winter League. Really looking forward to that. Should be a really fun experience. And then after that, I have no idea. You know, I'm 30. I have an injury history. I have a history of not really throwing strikes, all things that I'm trying to, you know, improve. But, you know, especially with these, the more contracted minor leagues, I don't know how great my shot is at getting back to affiliated ball. And I don't know what my prospects look like otherwise. And so it's sort of figuring out if I'm, you know, what the options are and if I'm going to, you know, keep rolling with this or figure out what's next for me.
Okay, well, I hope you get to keep rolling with this. Lee Dom's a lot of fun, at least when I'm able to tune in. I've never actually gotten to go down for it, but it seems like about. Have you played down there before?
No, this is my first time ever playing winter ball, and it's, you know, couldn't be a better spot to do it.
Nice. Do you know? I know they did the rookie draft recently. Like, do you know what your roster looks like already? Like, who your teammates are going to
be?
And stuff?
Okay, I'm not totally sure. I know the guys who have like historically played there. Okay. Like, I think Robinson Cano is a pretty big fixture on my team normally.
Nice.
So that'll be really cool. It's always like, you know, I was I said earlier I played with Vance Worley. Like, I remember watching Vance Worley when I was in high school. It was insane to get to like play on the same team as him. And I love Vance, but like Vance is not the same caliber of player that Robinson Cano is. Like, that's insane.
Yeah. It's
like, if nothing.
Sorry, go ahead.
If nothing else, that like, I may not have been a big leaguer. I've gotten to do some really cool things, and that'll be, you know, up there. It's just like, yeah, like this guy, I watched this guy when I was like 12.
Yeah, like, watched him playing. Win World Series and yeah. You know, be a perennial all-star and stuff like that. It's yeah, that'll be a lot of fun. I'm glad you get to do that. Okay, so on the other side of things, obviously pitching the foremost thing, but you have started to do things like host a podcast. You did the YouTube videos and stuff like that, charting your progress back. What led you to want to do that initially? Was it that uncertainty of like what was next for you? Let's try something new. Let's pull back the curtain.
Yeah, a little bit. I sort of like I like that sort of media aspect thing. I have like an urge to create things, and I am, you know, I have some talents in areas for doing that. Like I am an okay musician, but my doing the whole YouTube thing was more because like I needed something to keep me from losing my mind during my rehab. And that was where I started with it. And it ended up that I kind of, you know, by the end of it, I produced a couple of videos in there that were actually pretty solid. And it's funny that you say it was a 19-part series, because for 2 years I've been meaning to actually finish it, where I do a full look beginning to end, like almost a mini documentary, because that was my actual goal. And this was more my excuse to take the video that I was going to need along the way, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does make sense. Yeah, it's and it's cool. I mean, like, so what was the response to those? Like I don't know if I've seen all 19, but I remember the one with Adam Ottavino was one I really liked. Some of the pitch design stuff, like obviously you have the driveline background, so learning a little bit about, you know, obviously we hear guys trying to add velocity or pitch shape or whatever, but the rehab component of that was fascinating too. Was the response pretty good from people in baseball?
I think everyone who watched it seemed to enjoy it. I've gotten a lot of comments from just like, I think, you know, kids who are going through TJ, and they're like, this has actually been really helpful, like knowing what to expect, and like, you know, that I had setbacks and things like that, and it's just sort of a normal part of the process. And like knowing that somebody else has gone through that or is going through that is you know, helpful. It's like I'm not the only person this has ever happened to. Like, this is part of the process, and if that's the only impact that it has, I think it was totally worth it.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure that's super helpful for people. You know, the first thing I would do if I had to undergo Tommy John and I was a pitcher is start Googling or YouTube searching, what the hell am I in for here? So that part's good. So obviously, the rehab part, the mental side of that is something that's going to translate across people. How unique is that stuff for you, given that you're like a sidearm delivery guy? Like how much are... How much utility is there for you if you bring up something like that, if you go to driveline when so few guys throw from your arm slot? Like, do you have to tweak a lot of that stuff for your particular delivery?
Especially in the beginning, because I've been going to driveline. I've been using their stuff since 2016, which is like right around to just after when they started to come into the public eye in the baseball world. So at that point, it was incredibly, incredibly bare bones if you were outside of like a conventional thrower. So I did have to figure out a lot of that on my own. But I think that that was helpful in its own way, because it forced me to understand what I was doing and like how it affected me differently than it did a conventional pitcher. So I think it was in the long run helpful, even if it was more difficult at the time.
So you were using driveline back as far as 2016. Are you pretty like into some of the data and science stuff? I mean, you mentioned the seam shifted wake stuff at elevation. Like, is that something you've always tried to leverage to help you?
Yeah, as much as I have ever understood it. You said you don't have much of a physics background. I was a physics major in college.
Okay.
So I do have that sort of scientific background. It was always a very curious thing. Like I said, I wanted to learn how things worked, and so I've always sort of been that way. I think it has helped me in a lot of ways, and I think that it has been I've certainly looked into that side of things a lot more, especially on the pitch movement stuff, just because that's what I find most interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's cool. So you now, do you have a preference of, you know, if your graph comes in a blob versus in a frisbee style graph? Like, in seriousness, what is that part of the feedback process like? Like, are you kind of, do they or do you kind of seek out what you understand best and what you vibe with best?
I think that's what most people do, right?
Yeah.
Like even this past year in the Mexican League, I had our analytics guy just send me the CSVs from the games, like the TrackMan reports directly. And I, you know, I ripped off a bunch of other people's work to do this, but I built my own little report viewer so I could just see the things that I wanted, which was, you know, probably just good experience for doing that sort of thing. But yeah, I've certainly... And then I would have to keep changing it as just like, all right, well, this is important, though. And then we really need to look at this and just sort of iterating through it as I would, especially with how as like, all right, well, I changed some things I did to try to get better, you know, more outlier approach angles, vertical and horizontal. So we need those in the report. And it's just like, all right. But like also like my historic thing is I'm not very good at throwing strikes. How often was I in the actual strike zone? Or how, you know, what was my strike percentage, like including foul balls and swings and misses? And then it's like, well, it's also important to know that people are swinging and missing. So what's my swing and miss percentage? And like, it would keep iterating through and through as I was like, well, these things are important. So I need to know these things too.
It's fascinating. And, you know, as someone who, like, I don't have the physics background. I'm a numbers guy though. Like I would, you know, Mike Petriello's on next, and I would love to just bug him of like, hey man, we got to improve the Baseball Savant CSV customization ability there. Let me play around with this without getting all these lines that I don't need. So it's fascinating to hear that. Okay, wanted to go outside of that inside stuff. What is this time of year like for you as like a baseball fan? Like, I know you grew up in New York, went to college in New York. Your co-host is a Mets fan. You were in the Mets system. Like, you have a pretty good eye on that wild card race right now?
You know, actually not as much as you might think.
Okay.
I don't watch a ton of baseball.
Okay.
Right. Like I say this pretty frequently, but the job of a reliever is like 90% generously that it's not more like 90% watching baseball. So I do that all year and then I come home and I'm just like, I don't really want to watch any more baseball. I hadn't really kept up with how the Mets were doing. I just assumed that it was the normal like giant swings like, oh, man, they're doing great. Oh, man, they're the worst team that's ever played. You know, like they're known to do. But they're back in the wild card race now, I know.
Yes, they are in the final wild card spot by one game. But Francisco Lindor just got hurt. So typical Mets fashion, fight your way
and
back.
It's just over the Braves, right?
Yep.
Which is, you know, always a safe and comfortable lead.
Yes, with a series in Atlanta next week. So setting up perfectly.
I'll have to go check on Rich, make sure he's doing okay.
Okay, so you don't watch a ton of baseball, but I know you had a strong opinion. I watched your YouTube about how bad a baseball movie Trouble with the Curve is. Wanted to ask you, what is your favorite baseball movie? Like, what is the one that does it best if Trouble with the Curve is the worst?
I think it's Bull Durham.
Okay.
Like, Bull Durham is my favorite baseball movie. I think it does the minor leagues really well. It was written by a guy who had some time in the minors, so that makes sense. Major League is also fantastic. It's better when you're not taking it that seriously. Like, Moneyball's trying to tell a true story, but also trying to, like, you know, ignore the fact that they had, like, Barry Zito and...
Rich Harden.
Yeah, right. Like they had like the MVP, they had the Cy Young Award winner that year. Like they had really good players also. But Trouble with the Curve is just like a weird, it's just weird to me. Like it's not a bad movie by any means. I do enjoy it. It's just like the baseball is really bad. I do the same thing with movies that do like take real liberties with how physics works. Like I was an astronomy nerd as a kid, like learned a ton about like space travel and theoretical space travel. And like Interstellar is a wonderful movie that really, really plays fast and loose with the rules of like time dilation. And it's fine because it doesn't matter to most people. And for me, it's just like, this irks me. same thing with, you know, the kid walking into an open Braves workout and then letting him throw against their first rounder and doing so in tennis shoes. Like, it doesn't really matter, but it really annoys me personally.
Yeah, I get that. I it would bother me if there was not that anyone would ever watch a show or a movie about sports media, but it would bug me. Like the new, obviously everyone makes fun of the newsroom now, but even when like people liked it and it was new, there were a bunch of things just from like a journalism perspective. Like, there's no way this is ridiculous. Okay,
yeah, man. Exactly. I meant to make my dad watch Mad Men for the same reason, because he worked in advertising. Okay. A bit after that period ended. I'm curious as to how, you know, like if he is the same way. I imagine that I get this neuroticism from somewhere. So him doing that would probably be the same equivalent.
Yeah. Well, here's another future path for you or someone else, is like being the consultant on a baseball movie, to be like, nah, that doesn't track. That doesn't make sense. I feel like that'd be a cool role.
I wanted to write a baseball movie. I'm just not that gifted a scriptwriter. So I'm going to have to write 30 awful scripts before I get to that one. And that one might be, you know, not straight garbage. This was another thing. A friend of mine gave me a brief synopsis of a script that Trevor May had mentioned he wanted to write.
Okay.
1 year in spring training. And then Trevor May came on StaffCast and I told him like, yeah, so-and-so told me that you had this idea. And he was just like, oh, I do remember that. He was like, I've moved on from that one. You could have it. I was like, great. I'm taking it.
Nice. You're storyboarding, rates and barrels here now. Man, that's great. We could talk more offline about that. I was a writer before this, so we can get something going.
Yeah, that would be huge.
All right. Tom, thanks so much for taking the time out, man. Best of luck with Dominican Winter League.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you for having me. I'm glad to have, I've played in Mexico. I'm glad to have crossed the northern border in this way.
Yeah, get up here, man. The independent ball is not nearly as good here as in Mexico, but there are free tickets, and you could just sit on the hill and watch the Toronto Maple Leafs, they're called.
Yeah, I have a couple of friends who actually played in that league up there for, I forget which team, the something or something Red Sox.
Okay, Brantford, I think, is the
Brantford, Red Sox. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, nice. Well, we'll have to get you up here at some point. That, further down the line, though, you've got Dominican League, Mexican League. You've got bigger priorities for now. Thanks so much, Tom.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Tom Hackamer, former minor leaguer, current Mexican leaguer, and headed to the Dominican. And that podcast is called StaffCast. It's with Richard Staff, who is of amazing Mets. Mets guy there. But they go all over baseball. A lot of really good guests on there as well. Let's take a break. In the second hour, we'll talk to Mike Petriello of MLB.com, Chelsea Janes of The Washington Post. We'll talk to David Murphy of the Rangers broadcast, get you set up for this series as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
The best Blue Jays show out there, period. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Joining us now, a man who I just stumbled across his old Sportsnet author page from 10 years ago. It's Mike Petriello of MLB.com and Blue Jay Central. Mike, good morning. How are we doing?
Mike, I have a Sportsnet author page. What are we talking about?
You do, man. You wrote two things like a decade ago. You wrote a thing on Melky Cabrera heading into free agency and on King Felix and Clayton Kershaw having unbelievable seasons that were even better than the surface level stats back in 2014.
Wow, you will have to send those to me because I have zero recollection of this entirely.
This is, I believe there was, I was not at Sportsnet at this point. 2014, I would love to lie about my age and say I was in college or something still. But it appears that there was just like a regular Fangraphs stuff appearing at Sportsnet thing going on. But
that makes sense. Yeah, okay, that makes a lot more sense. I was definitely a Fangraphs back then.
Yes, of course. As we discussed when we were in New York, we have very similar paths of, let's light my original plan on fire and let's do sports and focus on sports numbers instead. Let's talk about sports numbers. Let's first, though, start. The Chicago White Sox have won three games in a row. I wore a White Sox hat today in honor of this team chasing the loss record. Man, they're probably going to get there. What do you make of that? Like, are they going to be 20 games better next year, even with worse players and a lesser payroll? Because how could you possibly be repeat as a 120-loss team?
I think there's a little bit to that. Like, it's hard to look at next year's team and say, yeah, they're going to be better, even though they traded away some of their good players this year, right? Like, Eric Fetty's not there anymore, although they did not trade Crochet. I just, you look at the numbers, and it is almost impossible to expect a team to be this bad twice in a row because everybody thought they were bad, right? I looked at my own personal projections entering the season, and I had them at, I believe, 57 and 105, right? Nobody thought they were going to be good. But in order to get from 105 to 119 or 120 or whatever they're going to end up with, everything for a bad team has to go badly. It's like the 10th percentile outcome, right? So I guarantee you this, when I look at next year's team and I do my projections again, that their loss total will again start with a one, and it might be like 108 or 109, but I could not reasonably say they will do this again because it just seems absolutely impossible. It can't be done. And don't run this back a year from now if we're talking about this again.
Yeah, I mean, look, they are going to be worse on paper somehow. It's not like even their prospects, and they don't have a bad system, but it's like a lot of double A guys, a lot of guys who are further away. And given the cheapness of that front office at times, probably guys they'll delay calling up if they can. If Edgar Quiero needs to work on one little thing at AAA, they probably keep him down at AAA. So we'll see how that goes. Let's pivot to real teams, kind of. Let's talk about the Blue Jays, who are only a couple games under 500. We saw this coming. I think you and I talked about it on the show ahead of the trade deadline. The Chad Green regression has come pretty hard and pretty quickly. I know his last outing was better, but he had blown four in a row or four out of five. What do you make of that when we're trying to level set and look at what the Blue Jays bullpen might look like next year? Kind of a tale of two seasons where he was really, really good, but outperforming the underlying stuff. And now it's gone the other way where, this is not how regression is supposed to work, but it is working that way in this case.
It is a little bit, right? I mean, I think the number one takeaway here is don't look at ERA for relievers unless maybe like Emmanuel Clase, right? Like if you're at that level, fine. But relievers, ERA for relievers, you know, you have one bad outing, it can pound your ERA for 2 months, right? And if you look at all the underlying metrics, and I want to be clear here, I'm not coming on your show to bash Chad Green. I like him very much as a pitcher, right? But when he had that shiny ERA right around the trade deadline, he looked under the hood and was like, well, these numbers are concerning. The strikeouts are down and the hard hit rate is up. And these aren't things that I would normally look at and say that this is the type of underlying profile that's going to maintain an ERA of, you know, two or whatever he had at the time. And I remember that being a big deal because at the trade deadline, there was a lot of talk about, hey, will the Jays trade him? Will they get a lot for him? And I said this either to you or to someone else in the market. I don't think they're going to trade him because the offers that you're going to want just aren't going to be there because teams aren't going to value him based on his ERA. Now, did I expect that it would kind of fall apart as much as it has over the last couple weeks? Not really, but I think that goes to show you the life of a reliever can really, really be up and down. And honestly, that's true of the entire Blue Jays bullpen, right? I came into the season thinking this was going to be a strength, not the best bullpen in baseball or anything like that, but I thought it's going to be a pretty good unit. And man, has it gone the other way, because that's what happens with relievers. So I think next year, hopefully they'll be more middle of the pack because so much has gone wrong this year that you just think that can't be repeated either.
And similar to our White Sox discussion, right? Like it's not going to be that bad again, because it's really unlikely for everything to go wrong twice in a row. Percentage wise. And like you said, I'm glad you said the point that you don't dislike Chad Green. We're not talking about him being a pumpkin. We're talking about the season long numbers now, which say he's about a 350 ERA guy. Those feel right now. That feels good.
That's great.
That's a good seventh inning guy. That's not a, hey, if you let Jordan Romano go in arbitration, that's your closer. That's, you got a lot of work to do in that bullpen. Let's stay on relievers. I do want to come back to a couple Jays topics if we have time. We had a great piece go up at MLB.com today about 12 unheralded relievers who could dominate in October. So before we get into some of the specific names, what were you looking for in coming up with this list? Because every year there are a couple ginkles, right? Hey, was the gink there? Yes, he was last year. These guys that influence it. But you can't necessarily predict who that's going to be just based on, hey, who is the best reliever? So what were you looking for in this group?
Yeah, when you get into the postseason, obviously it becomes a game of bullpens a lot sooner than it does in the regular season. And everybody wants the Josh Hader, the Emmanuel Clase, obviously the super studs, of course. But I looked at pitcher run value, like a Statcast metric from last postseason, and the top two names were Kevin Ginkle and Josh Zboris. And no disrespect to those guys, they're not household names, and yet they helped their teams get to the World Series. And if you go back, there's usually a guy or two every year who's not the elite closer, is not racking up saves, he's not an all-star, who gets hot at the right time. Like we just talked about with Chad Green, right? You get hot at the right time in October, you can really help your team go far. So that was my premise. I wanted to find guys who didn't make the All-Star team, aren't these big household names. Who might these guys be? And I was pretty happy not only at how many I could find, but such interestingly different career types. You have sort of failed first-round starting pitchers. You have guys who have been hurt forever. You have guys who have high ERAs, but the underlying metrics look really interesting, who might be getting hot at the right time. And every team, I think, has at least one of those guys, if not two. And I'm really hopeful that a month from now, we can look back at this list and say, oh, yeah, we saw this guy coming, and ignore the other 11. We don't care about those guys, but the guy I got right, we're gonna focus on.
Yeah, and look, if you throw 12 relievers, and they don't even have to be good relievers, you could throw 12 bad relievers out there. One of them's going to be good over a one-month sample. That's the way relief pitching works. But there are, like you said, there are a couple different interesting pockets of guy type here. There's obviously the AJ Puck, Michael Kopech. He's not in the piece because he's too established, but Jeff Hoffman's another one of these guys. The don't give up on the elite pedigree kind of guys, those ones are a little easier to figure out, right? Like, hey, this guy was a first round pick for a reason. He was a failed starter. Let's see what we can do. But then there are guys like Caleb Ort. My son is also named Caleb Ort. That those are a little tougher. Like he was on the waiver wire. He's in his 30s. How do we find the net? Like great for him. If he's a free agent, he'd go out and get paid and things like that. Jeff Hoffman's going to get paid. But at the team level, you're trying to find the next one of these guys, the next Caleb Ort. What are we looking for when it comes to scrap heap guys like that, for lack of a better term?
I think for a lot of those guys, it's a change in scenery, right? If you've had a particular voice in your ear for a couple of years and it's just not working, or you haven't been able to stay healthy, just getting somewhere new. And even if it's the same information, just having somebody new say it to you, having a different opportunity, that can help. But for most of these quote-unquote smart teams, and I think the Astros would certainly be counted among those teams, you've seen what they've done with Kikuchi, for sure, it's finding some raw material that they think they can mold. And it's not that the Red Sox don't have smart people working there, right? It could be that, you know, the way they tried to explain it didn't work. It could have been that they thought that he was going to figure it out with what he had, or maybe he was just resistant to change until he realized his career was in jeopardy. I don't know specifically with him, but he went to Baltimore in AAA this year and he was terrible. He had a 12.08 ERA in AAA, which I can tell you, that does not predict future success as well as you might think. But he was already throwing harder. And obviously, like most of these guys, there's been some injuries in the past. And now he's healthy. And now the velo is there. And it actually started before he got there. He started throwing a cutter with Baltimore a little bit last year, got hurt in spring training, didn't get to show it. And my guess is that the Astros saw this and they said, well, he can throw hard. We like what we've seen with this cutter in just short spurts, right? The metrics are good. We think if we can get him to stay healthy, get him to use the cutter a little bit more, maybe diminish the pitches that aren't working, we can get something there. And that's exactly what's happened. And if you go down the list of guys I had, there are so many examples where it's either A, healthy and throwing harder, or B, learned a new pitch or stopped throwing a pitch that wasn't working. And I don't want to oversimplify it because it's incredibly complicated to get there. But that's so much of it is, hey, use the pitches that work and throw them hard. Cool. We're good. Okay.
Awesome. Yeah, that's a great way to do it. Every team should just figure that out then, you know. But it is like, it's why we've had, and part of this is the way the season's gone, but it's why the Jays will take a look at a Tommy Nance. Because it's like, oh, well, the curveball's there. Can we figure out a way to deploy that effectively? And maybe it's not closer level, but maybe it's, you know, can you be Chris Bubich? Can you be Lucas Ursig, right? Like the Royals had to, that they did a good job kind of adding to this core, but it's a bullpen that has ranked near the bottom of baseball, and they at least found a couple guys doing that kind of thing. The other thing here with those two and Griffin Jacks, my takeaway is you got to have a cool name as a reliever. That's a part of this as well. Okay, so the Royals have patched together a little bit, but the overall bullpen numbers still aren't that strong for them. The Padres, on the other hand, have a ridiculous bullpen. AJ Preller went out and added multiple pieces at the deadline. Jeremiah Estrada is a name that you highlighted in your piece with that rising fastball and kind of splitter, whatever he calls it, formula. Do the Padres have the bullpen you would be most confident in heading into the postseason?
I think so, especially because there's a lot of teams where I'm just not confident in their bullpen. I'm not confident in Minnesota's, definitely not confident in the Yankees, right? I mean, some teams are Cleveland, I think, is the right answer.
Yeah.
Right? So no, not San Diego, Cleveland. But maybe in the National League, I think I might say San Diego. And that is because they've done a really good job of acquiring guys in every way imaginable, right? So Estrada, as you mentioned, the Cubs just let him go last fall. He was a waiver wire clean. And he, you know, was the guy who struck out 13 consecutive batters later this year. As the Padres do, they went out and made some huge trades, right? That's where they got Scott, and they traded for Jason Adam from Tampa Bay, and they've remade the bullpen kind of in real time. So that doesn't always work. I think that's the thing that surprised me more than anything else is over the last couple of weeks, like everybody they've gotten has succeeded, and that usually doesn't happen. Is that dumb luck? Is that a credit to their coaching staff? It's hard to say. But if you've got this many guys working together at the same time, and you can go out there and say, okay, we're going to start Dylan Cease. Joe Musgrove's getting healthy. Yu Darvish is coming back. Michael King has been great. And we're going to back it up with like six relievers we trust. That is a terrifying pitching staff. That's the team I don't want to face in October.
Yeah, that's a tough proposition there. And you mentioned the Guardians on the other side. They're the closest thing to that in the American League. And this, I intended to ask you about the Guardians anyway, because this is some CanCon. We have to do, you know, the CanCon rules. We have to have 33% talk about a Canadian team or Canadian players. Cade Smith rocks. Like almost three wins as a reliever, as a rookie. It's ridiculous. And by run value, his four-seam fastball is like the number one pitch in baseball. Even if we expect like a little bit of that to come back down to earth, what have you made of Cade Smith coming out? Like, he's two strikeouts away from the vaunted 100 strikeout reliever season, which doesn't really happen that much.
You know, listen, I really appreciate a Canadian kid going to college in Hawaii and just doing his best to avoid the lower 48 for as long as he possibly can. But here he is. And honestly, he should be in the rookie of the year conversation. He won't be because there's so many other guys. It's a pretty deep group this year, right? He's really interesting to me because, as you mentioned, his four-seam fastball has the highest run value of any pitch in baseball this year. You could say it's the most valuable pitch in the game. But it's interesting because he throws 96, which is, it's good, but it's not elite. It's not 100. It's not 101. It's not 102. So you'd think maybe there's some interesting rising action, like high spin. It's not really that easier. I think what's happening here is it's about the way he releases the ball. He's sort of a right-handed Josh Hader in some ways. Like, he's a tall man, he's 6'5", and he's got a little bit of a lower release point. And a lot of the talk in pitching circles these days are about approach angles and whether you're messing with the hitter's point of view about where they expect the ball to be coming from. And when you have a tall guy throwing a hard fastball from an unexpectedly low release point, that's a bad angle for the hitter. It also helps that he's got a split finger kind of coming in on the same plane until it falls off. So you look at their bullpen, other than Class A, these are not the guys they thought would be there, right? Like, Trevor Stephan got hurt, and Eli Morgan got hurt, and James Karinchak got hurt. And all of a sudden, you've got Hunter Gaddis and Smith and Class A and Tim Herron. And I wanted to put all of those guys in this article, except for Class A, as guys you don't know, because they've all been dominant this year. And that's going to be a really interesting group come October.
It is. And this is a fascinating 12 guys. The other thing that struck me about why they're so interesting is, like, we know when Emmanuel Clase is coming into a game, right? Like we have an idea, even if it's a manager who doesn't stick to the closer definitional role in the playoffs, you have a good idea of when those top guys are coming in. But these are the kind of guys, like, you could see Cade Smith in the fifth inning of a game if it's the right pocket of the lineup, and you could see him go, like, I think he's up over 70 innings this year, so you could see him go 4, 5, 6 outs or something like that. You know, Luke Weaver is another name in there. He's fallen off a little bit, but they'll use him in all sorts of situations. Might have to use him as a closer, or use someone who's not Clay Holmes as a closer in the stretch run here. Okay, that's probably enough on middle relievers on playoff teams. Great piece. Everyone should go check out the rest of those names and love some Cade Smith love. Want to pivot back to the Blue Jays, because you and I have talked about, and Francis, pretty much every time you've come on this year, we thought, hey, he could be a guy coming in. What's happening in the struggles? Oh, look, he's got a splitter now. And things have gone really, really well. I know before you came on here, you tweeted at least one yellow flag with the recent results. What have you made of where he's at now? Like again, as two guys who were relatively interested in Bowden Francis, how much has your opinion changed on what his outlook is?
I'm pleased with both of us because I think we were both on him pretty early in this process, right? So when I was on with you about a month ago, maybe you asked me how I felt about penciling him in for next year's rotation. And I was like, I'm not sure. I got to see a little more before I believe this. I think that question's been answered, right? Like, you are absolutely saying going into the next year, he is one of the starting pitchers on the 2025 Blue Jays. I worry a little bit that he's going to get a little overinflated and have these expectations that are unrealistic, right? And nobody expects him to keep taking no hitters in the ninth inning. But you look at what's happened in the second half when he's been fantastic, obviously. And the batting average on balls in play is 119, right? That means about 10%, 11% of the balls that don't turn into home runs turn into hits, which is an obscenely low number that is wildly good luck. And in fact, it's the lowest second half number basically ever since the end of World War II. That doesn't happen. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. Like, if you're going to pitch like one of the best pitchers in baseball for a sustained stretch, which he has, you're going to have some good fortune. Like, things are going to go right. That's fine. That's not a dig against him at all. But you look at some of the underlying second half numbers, and like, his fielding independent pitching is 388. You know, the expected numbers are more in the 350 range. And that's, I think, more where I see him, because I look at a pitcher who's now got a collection of good pitches, but I'm not sure I see like one particular elite level standout pitch like Cade Smith's fastball, you know? And you don't have to have one of those. You don't have to have Kevin Gausman's splitter to be your carrying pitch. It's great if you do, but not everybody does. And I think I'm looking at him more as a good mid-rotation pitcher. And I know that sounds like a dig, but that's incredibly valuable in today's game if he can sustain that over a full year next year.
Yeah, I mean, he was in AAA and the bullpen this year. For him to be a mid-rotation starter next year is still a huge win. And to say that he's not going to consistently break Jacob DeGrom's record for lowest whip over X number of starts is not... the only thing I'll push back on, well, two things. One is that some of his, like, obviously batting average on balls in play is an important indicator. We have expected stats based on quality of contact. And his, they're not 120 BABIP good, but they're pretty good still. He's induced a lot of weak contact still. And the other is Hoyt Wilhelm comes up on those lists a bunch of times. He survived bad BABIP until he's like 50 years old. So maybe Bowden Francis is the new Hoyt Wilhelm BABIP king. No, in seriousness, so if you are... if you were looking for Bowden Francis, obviously he's probably going to be in the rotation next year. If we think, say, he's a 350 to 375 ERA guy over a whole season, what are you looking for from him to start next year? Like, should the priority be, hey, if you could add a tick or two to the fastball, hey, one of the curveball or sliders got to be, you know, a more effective third pitch. What would that next step for Bowden Francis look like?
Well, I would say add a tick or two to the fastball is applicable to pretty much every pitcher in the game,
sure,
right? Like, if you can do it, wonderful. I'm not going to put that on him. Oh, you got to be throwing 96 next year. But yeah, I think what's happened here is the splitter has proven itself to be a pretty good addition. I think the four-seamer is an above-average four-seamer. It doesn't have great velocity, but it's got a little bit of that rise you're looking for. And he has mostly ditched the curveball, although it's come back a little bit. And I think you can't get by without elite velocity if you're just going to be a four seam and splitter pitcher, right? I think he's got to get one of those breaking balls up to being a good usable pitch. And it has been in the past. Like, the curveball was better when he first came up. Mm-hmm. I'm not entirely sure why it seems to have diminished a little bit, but it's there. And I think that's really interesting. So if he can get that back, maintain the velocity or even increase it, I think that's a good path to success next year. And I can tell you this, Blake, one thing that none of the numbers take into account is just the absolute coolness of taking a no-hitter into the ninth inning and then riding your bike home from the ballpark. That's awesome. And we need to start accounting for stuff like that in metrics.
Yeah, I mean, his vibe plus is out of control. He is a great dude to talk to about pitching, about just whatever. Good energy around him. And that's part of why, you know, all the Jays root for him so hard. And the curveball thing's interesting because when he first came up last year, it was the standout thing to me because he was throwing it for strikes a lot. And he was like, quote unquote, pitching backwards a lot of the time and using his curveball and fastball counts and stuff like that. And I know it was something he had worked on in the Puerto Rican Winter League the winter prior. And now it's like, yeah, we put that story aside because there's a splitter now. I do kind of trust a guy like that who's been able to get more out of a pitch multiple times now and kind of reinvent himself on the fly. You just kind of think that, trust, I guess, that guy will be able to continue figuring things out. Last question for you, Mike. This is from a viewer, so apologies to those on radio who can't see. Someone asked where you got the baseball guitar behind you.
Yes, I do have a baseball guitar. So that is a real Les Paul Gibson, and I hang it up. I'm a pretty decent bass player, but all I can do is power chords on the guitar, so I feel bad playing it. I'm not like up to par for it. I got that from my friend and colleague Corey Schwartz, who works at MLB and has been running a lot of the stats there for basically ever since day one. And it was like a marketing thing, and he is a guitar player as well, and we like to talk about music a lot. And a couple years ago he asked me if I wanted it, and I said yes, I absolutely want it, because you know it's cool to have and it's a great Zoom background. So I will always be appreciative of Corey for that, so thank you.
Yeah, it's cool. And to the person who sent that in, whose name I already lost in my notes, there is your answer. Mike, thanks so much for taking the time out. I look forward to watching you on Blue Jay Central this evening.
I will be there. Thanks, Blake.
And I managed to not burn your topic, even though it was in my notes. Looking forward to it. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you.
Mike Petriello of MLB.com. Great piece on impact relievers for the playoffs ahead here. And again, he'll be on Blue Jay Central tonight, I believe, talking about the fact that the Toronto Blue Jays have the best hit-by-pitch person in baseball. Hit batsman. I'm fond of saying like a beersman if you drink a lot of beers. A woodsman, obviously, if you're in the woods. I got a hit batsman, I guess. Anyway, Leo Jimenez gets hit by like almost 10% of the pitches that come on the inside part of the plate, which is like centuple the league average and way, way higher than anyone else. I believe Mike will be talking about that on Blue Jay Central if you want to hear more. We've talked about it a little bit on this show as well. Let's take a break. Let's talk to Chelsea Janes of the Washington Post on the other side. We'll look a little closer at some of these playoff races. We'll also get you set up for Jays Rangers, Nate Eovaldi against, we think, Chris Bassett, but it's not locked in just yet. All that's next as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Fresh views on everything in the National Football League. It's the Fan Checkdown with Matt Marchese and Donovan Bennett. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. The Jays are in action against the Rangers, and then they will wrap up the season over three more series with teams that are not particularly relevant to the playoff race unless the Red Sox make a really late push here. There are a couple of really, really good playoff races going on, though. So let's check in on them. Let's talk to Chelsea Janes of the Washington Post. Good morning. How are we doing?
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming on. So I saw you tweet about it yesterday. Were you around the Mets for the Francisco Lindor news yesterday?
Yeah, I'm in New York for their series this week, so I was there.
So the Francisco Lindor news is not the best news ever, but not the worst news ever. What do we make of that? I know the Mets have the one-game cushion now, but you lose potentially the MVP for a couple games here with only 12 games left. Got to be high tension times around that Mets squad.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, you know, Francisco Lindor had back problems for, you know, bordering on 2 weeks and finally got an MRI and it was clean. But, you know, it's going to be something he said he'll have to manage. So what does that mean? Does that mean he's at full strength the rest of the season? Does it mean he's compromised in some way? Does it mean he's kind of off and on in the lineup, out of the lineup? You know, I don't think they know. But at this point, the Mets have basically 2 weeks to play for a season, for a playoff berth in a season that they didn't expect to get one. And I think, you know, it's kind of corny, but I think at this point it's all vibes. So, you know, having him at all, I think is going to be a huge help to them.
It is. It really does. It is all vibes. And like the Braves have like hung on, stitched together with silly string with all these injuries and stuff. And the Mets have just kind of been like grooving in there. And it seems like obviously a terrible, terrible start, but everything's gone well since. I mean, what do you make of the Braves side of this where, you know, again, they're just kind of hanging on and they've lost so many pieces. Obviously, the staff is still really good, but it feels like maybe just one too many here for them.
Yeah, it might be. I mean, the problem with them is they're really good. So, you know, even down Austin Riley, even, you know, Ozzie Albies may or may not be back, you know, may or may not be switch hitting. Like the depth is just so significant and so is the experience. So I think you still don't want to see them in the playoffs because they could take off. I mean, they could be that team that gets hot. But that being said, I mean, it's been a rough year for them. I think there's a lot of reason to wonder if they can kind of hang on in the face of a team that looks pretty hot right now, like the Mets. But I promise you that the rest of baseball is hoping they can't, because I think everyone knows that if you get them in October with their pitching staff, with Sale and Fried and you know, everyone they have to offer, they could be pretty formidable.
Yeah, whereas on the Mets side, you know, vibes reset for the playoffs, right? And it's right. nice to have, right. you know, Sean Manaea and David Peterson and stuff, but they're not Max Fried and Reynaldo Lopez and those guys. So it's and Chris Sale, obviously. So that's a tough one. For anyone who doesn't know, by the way, the Braves have Cincinnati, Miami, and Kansas City left. The Mets have Washington, Philly, and Milwaukee. So probably you give it to the Mets a little bit tougher a schedule. But of course, these teams play next week in Atlanta. Very cool to have it come down to basically, like, that could be a play-in series.
Yeah, totally. And I think that, you know, the Yankees-Orioles series next week is basically for the division. I mean, it's turned out to be kind of a pretty fun, I think, kind of end to this year.
So, okay, let's take a look at the AL side of this now. And I know a couple weeks ago you did kind of a contenders check-in, and the spirit of it, of your piece was like, well, there are no elite teams this year, right? Like, nobody's going to win 100 games. We might not have a team in the AL win 95 games. It's pretty odd to see. Do you think that is a byproduct of, like, the expanded wild card and more teams being in it, or is this just a blip? Like, after you wrote that, what did you make of the fact that there is no kind of standout team or even standout teams, really?
I think it's a couple things. I think, first of all, I think the pitching injuries have changed the dynamic. I think it's an injury change season. I think there's teams that could have if everyone were healthy, but that's just sort of not the world we're living in. You know, I think also the wild card does mean you don't have to try to be great. You know, if you're going to go out and get that one more guy that might have made you an unstoppable regular season team, you're probably thinking, do we do that since, you know, we can get in the playoffs and try to make a run anyway? So I think that's also part of it. But I think it's more of a blip than anything. And I also am curious how much teams value the division win, given that in the new playoff format, it seems to be a bit of an issue to kind of take the break that earns you. You know, if you win the division, you get 4 days off, 5 days off while you wait for the wild card series to finish. And that has not been an asset to people. So I don't think it's as much of a priority as it's been in the past, but I don't expect it to be a pattern. I think it's more of a blip.
Yeah. And it's interesting how all those incentives work. And, you know, there's a component too of maybe more teams are actually still trying this late. So you don't get a couple extra wins off of teams that have bowed out. But yeah, that idea that statistically the bye through the first round feels like it should be really, really meaningful. You have a 100% chance of getting through the first round, but yeah, I mean, it's great to get your starters an extra day of rest or whatever, come in with a rested bullpen. But that element of, I don't know, I've asked a couple guys about it. No one seems to want to take 4 or 5 days off. People say it takes them a series after even just like the All-Star break. I don't know what we do about that short of making the wild card a one game series or something like that.
Right. You know, people have gotten creative. I think ultimately the answer in this format is probably like figure it out, but it's not that easy. It's such a momentum sport. And, but you know, I think there's all these kind of fun solutions of like, have the team that wins the division choose. Do you want to play? Do you want to wait? You know, something like that. I'm sure they would never do that because it's kind of a little bit too crazy, but something like that would be fun. But, you know, it's now been a couple years and it just seems like that is a hindrance rather than an asset. And unless you're super injured and those 5 days get you really good players back, I don't think it helps.
Yeah. Like in this case, I mean, the Braves would love it right now, right? Like they would love to have that. The Phillies probably don't care. Their rotation's rolling. All their main guys are healthy. There's, I think, one guy on the IL right now. They probably want to keep it rolling and stay in that groove. Okay, so no elite teams. We thought maybe in the American League that it would be the Orioles. And obviously, development is not linear. You come to the show. There's the, you know, the Pat Riley term, the innocent climb. There are no expectations. People aren't ready for you. That kind of first turn is the easier one. And I know you wrote about this last week. That this jump is much, much harder. The jump from we've got here to now we're a team that everyone's ready for and coming for and things like that. How have, or in your estimation in writing that piece out, how have the Orioles handled the pressure of that? There now being expectations and, you know, a tough division race and some of these young guys struggling and things like that. Much tougher year.
Much tougher year. I think, you know, organizationally, they will probably assess it in the context of what happens over the next few years. You know, did we win next year? Did those deals we made that maybe didn't pay off this year look good in hindsight, and maybe they will. But I think when you look at how the Orioles as a whole have handled this year, particularly their front office, it has been clear, I think, that they don't feel they have to win right now, right? That they see this window open and they're not going to do anything to, I don't know, trade guys that they really need. They're not, they didn't go out and get the big, big name at the deadline. They made some deals for Zach Eflin and Trevor Rogers, who's now in the minors, much to people's chagrin. So it was just a very cautious handling of a team that is on the verge. And I don't think they got the support they needed. I think they've had a lot of injuries. Everyone has. But it will be interesting to see, you know, if they're right, if this wasn't their year because of the injuries. And so, you know, they didn't need to kind of go all in at the deadline to get a guy like Kikuchi or something. But right now, it certainly looks like they needed more pitching help than they got themselves. And combine that with the fact that some of their young guys are hurt, that Adley Rutschman is struggling like he's never struggled before. And you have a team that's, I think facing the reality of how hard it is to do what they did last year when it felt easy.
Yeah, and how hard it is to do it year over year, and how hard it'll be to do it in the playoffs. And yeah, I mean, those are things that if they win a championship a year or two from now, everyone will be like, oh, those were great learning lessons. That's how you got here. But the narrative shifts if they don't end up winning one. And then it's like, well, you missed the best opportunity when all these guys were cheap. So it's, you know, the how it turns out will determine the narrative, even if that's not fair necessarily. So elsewhere in the American League, the Orioles and Yankees kind of traded the AL East back and forth. The Yankees in a little bit more control right now. But since maybe the start of June, it's kind of quietly been the Astros who have been maybe the best team in the American League. They erased that 10-game division deficit. They're not going to catch the Yankees and Guardians and Orioles in the standings, but they've looked good for a little while here, and they did go out and get a Yusei Kikuchi. I know in late August you wrote about that. How do you feel about where that team is? And I guess it maybe forces us to recontextualize some of the front office discussion that was happening, you know, when that turned over, right? And it looked like maybe they had fallen off that James Click out, Bagwell's influence and stuff. It maybe looks a little different now.
Yeah, I think it does look different. I don't know if it should. I think, frankly, they continue to be bailed out by the fact that they've just, in Bregman and Altuve, they just have two extremely experienced players who sort of refuse to let that team fall off. And Kyle Tucker, they've come back into the race without Kyle Tucker, who will come back, you know, one of the most sort of overlooked players in baseball, but a real impact guy. You know, Yordan Alvarez is elite when he's healthy. And that core, I think, has made them successful this year, that and their pitching, which is always really good, and has somehow become good again, even though they've got a lot of injuries. You know, I think the front office getting Kikuchi was a huge and necessary move. I think it's kind of too early to say like where their trajectory is headed. Are they, you know, in a position to keep replenish themselves over the next few years, or is this kind of it? But every time it's looked like they were going to finally fall off, you know, eventually Bregman, Altuve, Alvarez, those guys just pull them back, and they did it again this year. And I think it's hard not to see them in a CS again, because they just know what they're doing and they've got the arms, and it, you know, somehow they've got the rotation they need to like be experienced and formidable in a short series. And, but it's getting to the point now where it's amazing that they're able to keep doing this. But you know, this year, at least before Bregman hits free agency and, you know, Verlander kind of ages his way out of things, I think they're probably in the CS again, and therefore have a chance to make another World Series.
Yeah, it's fascinating, and we'll see. Obviously, the playoffs are so random that, you know, you get one bad start from someone and you bounce, and it's not as if, you know, there aren't. I guess maybe the Twins look weak enough that you'd be comfortable in that matchup, but you certainly don't want the Royals.
No.
Like that's I know you wrote about them the other day. I'm just kind of going through the checklist of all the great stuff you've been writing lately. So what do you make of the Royals? This is obviously a Royals team that, you know, a very fascinating way they put this together with, hey, Bobby Witt Jr. is ready. The rest of the prospects maybe aren't. We got to add some vets, but not expensive vets. And then here they are, kind of like, I thought they'd be better this year. I don't think I really thought of them as a playoff team yet. Can they make some noise in a couple weeks here?
they're just like a perfect example of what you said, you know, with what happens when you don't have expectations, right? Yeah. It was so easy for them to exceed expectations that anything they do is just such a bonus. And I think that builds in a long season. You know, Bobby Witt Jr. is a game-changing player. They've got a lot of speed, you know, in him and others, and that always plays in October. I think they're the kind of team that accidentally ends up in the World Series. You know, I think them and maybe like the Padres on the other side are two teams that like it's there. If, you know, I think the Royals aren't as talented as a lot of other teams, but their pitching's been good. You know, they've, you know, Sal Perez has been there before. They've just kind of got all these pieces where maybe next year it doesn't come together the same way, but this year it is. And, you know, Bobby Witt Jr. is a really, really good baseball player who changes every game that he's in. And again, when you get into those games where every little thing matters, you know, they're a hot streak away. But and especially if they play the Orioles in the first round, which I think is what you're looking at now, they might catch the Orioles kind of flat footed, and who knows what happens after that.
Okay, so from one Kansas City Royals legend in Bobby Witt Jr. to another in Chris Getz, the general manager of the Chicago White Sox. I know you had a tweet the other day, kind of the Twitter version of rolling your eyes at Chris Getz saying, well, these are the cards we've been dealt. And then there were the comments last week about how they're probably going to trim the payroll for next year, which even if you understand from, these guys are coming off the books situation. What have you made of the White Sox here? Three wins in a row here, but they're going to break the league record for futility, and they seem very who cares about it. I don't think it's a great thing.
No, it's a little bit incomprehensible because, you know, they're doing this while they're asking for a new stadium. So there's that. But it's also, they're doing it in an era where being the absolute worst doesn't even get you the top pick necessarily. Like, because they're a big market team, the new draft changes, you're not guaranteeing yourself a run of top draft picks like, say, the Orioles got to turn things around. And you don't appear to have the infrastructure to do anything with those draft picks once you get them. So, you know, trimming payroll from a roster that has none, you know, left is just, it's kind of maddening. And I think they, you know, I don't know what the plan is, but they're a long way from having one, I think, that is hopeful. They've got a lot of young talent. They've shown no ability to develop it. And I don't know what you do with that, but there were times with the Astros, with the Orioles, some of these other rebuilds where you looked at it and you were like, I see why you're tanking. This is like, there's no point to being this bad. And it wouldn't take that much to be a little better even. So they're in a weak division where the Royals didn't pay that much money and got a really good, you know, it's just negligence basically. And I don't think MLB is going to do anything about it because Jerry Reinsdorf is a long-term owner, you know, a guy who's got a lot of sway, but it's pretty bad.
The Bulls are going to be real bad too. So Jerry just soaking it in, I guess. I don't know. It's not what I would do if I had enough money to own two professional sports teams. I feel like at least with one, if you're going to be cheap with one of them, do that in the service of like, oh, the Bulls are going to spend into the luxury tax and be really, or vice versa. Don't tank both of them. Okay. The Jays are about to see the Texas Rangers. Obviously not a good year for the Texas Rangers, but Chris Young got an extension the other day coming off of that World Series, kind of a delayed bonus for that. What do you make of where the Rangers are and the position they're in to be one of these bounce back teams in 2025? You know, if Chris Young can tweak a couple things, get a little bit of health here and there.
Yeah, I think they're just like a classic team that had to drain everything they had to win. And, you know, Scherzer broke because of it. A lot of their guys started the season hurt because of it. You know, they just kind of emptied the tank. And then when a few people got hurt, they couldn't bounce back. I think that's, you know, not inexplicable. You know, I remember those Giants teams who won in every even year. It was like, well, their pitching staff had to recover because they just got destroyed going to, you know, through the playoffs. So I think that's what happened with Texas. They've got plenty of money, even though their cable situation is a little weird. You know, Chris Young's got them on a good track. I think they're probably, you know, a few healthy starters away from a much better season. Kumar Rocker looked really good in his debut. You've got Jack Leiter coming. You know, they've got prospects on the big league roster, and you know, they're in really good shape. I think they're just an example of what happens when you kind of accidentally win the World Series and have to drain every arm you've got to do it, and it just doesn't bounce back.
I would love to have to pay the legacy costs of accidentally winning a World Series. Yes, it would be wonderful 100%. To be in that situation. Chelsea, before I let you go here, this question is outdated, but I haven't spoke to you much this season. I know you got to go to Japan early in the year and take in some NPB baseball there. How was that experience?
Awesome. Really cool experience. Just incredibly dedicated to fundamentals over there. Like, that was my main takeaway is, you know, they would just do bunting practice right next to batting practice and no one worried about getting hit in the head. You know, here, if you're anywhere near infield, you know, someone's going to overthrow and hit you. And those guys were just so dedicated to detail. And I think it shows when those guys come over here. But yeah, really cool experience. The fans, the singing, it's awesome. I hope everyone kind of gets to go. And I think it would be so cool someday if they could, you know, play a real World Series against whoever wins in MLB. But yeah, awesome experience. I was so lucky to get to do that.
The hype for Roki Sasaki, I know he got outpitched earlier this week, but the hype, if that was, hey, the next guy who's going to get the big money contract, or if he gets posted early, not the big money contract. But yeah, that'd be a ton of fun. I would love to see that. We'll have to suffice with the 2026 World Baseball Classic, I guess, as our next kind of taste of something like that. Chelsea, thank you so much for taking the time out this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Chelsea Janes of the Washington Post, a lot of great work there. We kind of whipped around the contenders there. This is the time of year for that. There are 14 teams ostensibly in the playoffs, in the playoff picture right now. Technically, it's a little bit more than that if you think the Red Sox can make up four games or whatever. But as a quick reset, the Jays-Rangers series is not particularly relevant to the playoff picture. But the Tigers have gotten in within a game and a half of the Twins for that last American League spot. The Mariners are only two games out of that spot as well. So we do have a battle there in addition to the Yankees being only three games ahead of the Orioles with a series still to go between those teams. And then obviously over on the NL side, Mets a game up on the Braves with a series still against them. Diamondbacks only one game clear of that mess as well. So we got a lot of fun baseball over these last 13 days of the season. The Jays will be playing as well. It's Nate Evaldi tonight. We think it's Chris Bassitt. We don't know. The Jays haven't announced the probables, so they could do something. You know, I believe it was Bassitt's last start where we said, yeah, we think Bassitt's starting tonight. We teed it up as such, and then they went with a Ryan Burr-led bullpen day instead. Possible they do that. They will need one of those in this stretch of games if they want to keep everyone particularly well-rested and, you know, with that extra day or two here and there. So we'll see. If it is Evaldi, you know him pretty well. I mentioned a little earlier, he needs four innings to collect on a $20 million vesting option for next year. So a lot of money on the line for Evaldi tonight and over his final start if he does throw another one. You know who he is now. He has had 5 years with his ERA between 3.63 and 3.87. That is Jose Barrios levels of remarkable consistency for Evaldi. He's trimmed the walk rate. He strikes out a reasonable number of guys. All the underlying metrics basically agree with his ERA. He is about as known a known commodity as you can get, again, short of like a Jose Barrios. So you know what to expect with him. You've seen him a ton over the last couple of years. Couple quick texts in the text line before we wrap up for the day. Fred and Markham asks, why am I not talking about the Jays' race to pass the Rays for fourth in the American League East? Because I do not care that much. And in fact, you could make a case that the reverse standings are more importance given the lottery odds and things like that. Although, you know, I know in baseball that matters a little less than in some other sports. But the Jays are in a five-team mess right now for the fifth to ninth lottery odds, which is a swing of 1.9% chance to 7.5% chance at the top pick. It's not nothing, and that obviously informs also your slot pool for your entire draft and things like that. It's not meaningless. So that's not to say I think they should tank these last 12 games. Just I am not that concerned with catching the Tampa Bay Rays for fourth in the division. Ed and Aurelia had asked, if the Jays are concerned about Gossman's diminished velocity, why don't they have him work on a third pitch in the offseason? I mean, technically, he did that last year. He came in this year and reintroduced the sinker, the two-seamer that he hadn't thrown since back when he was in Baltimore. He's thrown that, you know, about 150 times this year. He's also thrown 225 sliders. So between those two pitches, that makes up about 15% of his arsenal. Yeah, ideally one of those would be a more effective weapon. I don't even know, like his velocity's down, but it's only down like half a mile per hour on the season. It's ticked upward at the end here. I don't know that that is Like, obviously, higher velocity is always preferable, all else equal. I don't know that that's like a smoking gun of him having a bit of a drop off this year, certainly at times. But I don't think he needs to, you know, I don't think that's how you're framing it. Oh, his velocity has dropped, so X, so Y. I think as a two-pitch pitcher, you would like to, you know, figure out how to throw that slider a little bit better in general, or figure out how to make that sinker more of a weapon, or whatever it is. You know, as a fastball splitter guy, you always have to worry about how your other pitch is going to tunnel off of that, which is kind of why he's gone slider one way, two-seamer the other way. So those two compare together as a kind of co-third offering. But yeah, lots to look ahead to with respect to that. If Chris Bassett goes tonight, what we'll be watching for is his ERA is at 4.20 right now. He's probably got two starts left. I'm sure he would love to get that under four, because that would mean a seventh consecutive season or partial season with an ERA under four for him. I'm sure that would be nice. Okay, that's it for today. Thank you to Chelsea Janes, to Mike Petriello, to Tom Hackamer, to Ben Shulman. Apologies, we didn't end up getting David Murphy, but I believe he'll be on Blair and Barker a little later. So if you want to hear from him, a terrific analyst on the Rangers broadcast, you can do so. Blair and Barker, 4 to 6 a.m. postgame. We'll be back at 10 a.m. tomorrow. Have a wonderful Tuesday.